Let's return to our study in the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings, chapter number 4, verse 26, where I promised you we would come back and expand on what I was talking about when we wrapped up yesterday. The text says, "To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh." So Seth is the replacement son, if you wish, of Abel that had been killed by Cain. And he, when he grows up, has his own son that he names Enosh. And it is in the time of either Seth or Enosh that the next line starts becoming a reality, where it says, "At that time, he," and the verb is a singular verb. So the English standards wording here, people, which is kind of a plural sort of concept, is a little bit misleading. There is an individual in mind here that starts this process, which people then adopt for their own practice. "So at that time, he began to call upon the name of he who is." Now, don't get wrapped up in the idea that we see the use of the divine name that doesn't come into existence until the time of Moses being used in reference to worship that goes way back to the second and third generation of humanity. It's just one of those things that we sometimes do. We talk about things in the verbiage we're familiar with, even though that verbiage might have not existed previous. So the point that's being brought out here is that religion now comes into a slightly different form. And I shared with you my own belief that when Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, they seem to have settled right there at the gate, near where the cherubim, the four-faced, four-winged guardian angels, were standing with their sword to keep them from coming back into the garden and eating of the tree of life and remaining sinners into eternity. They began raising their family in close proximity to that place. And I believe that it wasn't just simply the angelic beings there. I believe that we had some sort of representation of what later we call the Shekinah glory, the tower of God, the throne of God that rises up above these angelic beings into the sky with the light and the lightning and all of those things that Ezekiel describes. It is some sort of physical manifestation of God's limited presence on planet Earth. It's actually, in my opinion, based on some phrases out of Isaiah, the visible and physical manifestation of the Holy Spirit of God. And so I believe that Adam and Eve began worshiping right there, showing their honor and offering their sacrifices right there in the presence of that glory. But when Cain was told of his penalty, he was frustrated that because he was now exiled from this community, he would no longer be in the presence of the Lord. He would no longer be in the face of the Lord or see the face of the Lord. So I think that kind of strengthens the idea that I'm presenting to you here. Over time, as the population grows, they're going to have to spread out. They're going to have to be farther away. And that means it's not going to be convenient to trek back many hours, possibly a couple of days, to this location to do your worship. So instead, they're going to do the worship where they live. And it is interesting, in the book of Genesis, when we see this phrase, "began to call upon the name of he who is," it's related to another phrase, and he built there an altar and began to call upon the name of He Who Is. So we now see worship sites, I think, being set up farther away from the original site of worship. And that makes perfect sense with the spreading out of humanity. So it's either Seth or his son Enosh that begins this religious activity away from the original site. And that will be repeated over and over again, and then it will start being mutated by those that change who it is that they're worshiping. Because the activity of Satan, with his deception and his fallen angels joining in this operation of deception, there will be the development of other gods and goddesses concepts. And these worship sites will be devoted not to the one and true living God, but to pseudo gods and goddesses, false deities. So we'll keep that in the back of our mind as well. Chapter number 5 goes through the genealogy through Seth, helping us get prepared for the next big shift in humans' history. And that will eventually be the flood. So Genesis chapter 5, verse 1 says, "This is the book of the generations of Adam." And this is one of our Toledot passages, one of the places that represents a significant section in the larger book of Genesis. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. We remember that. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man, Adam, when they were created. So it's a reminder here, God created Adam and Eve as the beginning of a larger group. And he expected them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and make it their home. And so now we go through the list of how that is happening. And the interesting thing about this list, two things, is first of all, it follows the line that actually makes it through the flood. All the other arms of humanity don't make it. They are wiped out because of sin. It is only the Seth line, and then all the subdivisions that we will follow of that Seth line, that makes it through the waters of judgment. Second interesting thing is we see numbers put in place here. And this is where I have to talk to you about textual issues. We know from our introduction that the original documents, the first autograph of the book of Genesis, is not available. It disappeared way back in history. But handwritten copies were made of that original, and then copies were made of the copies, and copies were made of the copies of the copies, and we just keep moving forward in time. And the Bible that we have today is a very good representation of the originals because of the care that was taken by these generations of copyists, these scribes. Unfortunately, even the most attentive handwriting scribe can make errors. And most of those errors, if you go back and do textual criticism studies, most of those errors are related to numbers and the spelling of names. Both of those are really difficult to hand copy. If you don't believe me, sit down sometime and try to hand copy the first few chapters of First Chronicles, and then have someone check you. more than likely you will have made multiple errors in your copy because it's just tough. So we end up with different manuscripts with different numbers and sometimes the different spellings of names. And we have to compare those and then make choices of what we will put into our text as we print it. There are two lines of manuscripts that I'm going to reference here as we look at these numbers. The one that you are going to be the most familiar with is called the Masoretic Text. This is the common Hebrew text under most English translations. It comes from the Middle Ages. It is not as old as the Septuagint, which began as a translation from Hebrew into Greek right around 280 BC. We have older copies of the Septuagint than we have of the Hebrew text, at least in Genesis, what we're talking about here. I believe that the numbers in the Septuagint, which are larger than the ones in the Masoretic text, are the more accurate ones. Now, I'm not saying they are the absolute original numbers. They themselves may have issues. But I think they are the ones to be preferred by those of us that want to take this process seriously. And I have made a chart, which is in my Chronological Companion to the Bible notebook, of these two competing text lines to show the passage of time during the time before the flood and how it changes just how old we think the story is. You can find a copy of my Chronological Companion on the website, intotheword2020.com. The Masoretic text almost always is 100 years less in some of these numbers than the Septuagint text. And so you end up with a chronology that only goes back to a creation somewhere in the 4000s BC. Bishop Usher, working in the 1600s, working with the manuscripts that he had available and the chronological notes that he had, he came up with the idea of 404 BC. And you'll sometimes hear that as some sort of authoritative number. It is not authoritative by itself. It simply represents the chronological works of a man living in the 1600s. When I used the Masoretic text that I had available to me, came to the year 4180 BC. But when I used the Septuagint text, the Greek Old Testament text, the manuscripts that I had available to me, that was pushed back because of the difference in the numbers to 5570 BC, making our created world over 7,000 years old, over 7,500 years, or 7,500 years old. And I think that probably better represents the reality of the young Earth's age. When you talk to young Earth creationists, they will usually tell you that the Earth is somewhere between 6 and 10,000 years of age. And the reason they use that upper range of 10,000 is because some of the scientific evidences give a little bit older date, and they understand, as I'm trying to explain to you, that maybe even the Septuagint numbers might be slightly off still and not as old as it could be. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read to you the Genesis 5 genealogy, giving you first the Masoretic text number that's in our English Bibles, and follow it up immediately with the number that appears in the Septuagint, so that you can see the comparisons. If you want to look at them yourself, again, go to my notes and check those out. So here we go. Genesis 5, 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, the Septuagint says 230 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness and after his image, and he named him Seth. And the days of Adam after he fathered Seth was 800 years. And he had other sons and daughters. And so we have all of these different kids that Adam has over many, many centuries. And then he passes away. Verse number 5. Thus all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And that's the exact same number in both the Masoretic and the Septuagint text. Now, that means, practically speaking, that he lived to see the fifth generation of humanity. So that's a good long time. Now, these numbers should not be surprising to us when compared to our modern-day lifespans, because things radically changed in the environment of the earth after the flood. Nutritional availability and the protective atmosphere all seem to be radically lessened after the flood. And in the text of Scripture, you see the average lifespan precipitously drop until it arrives roughly right around the same sort of range that we have to this day. All right, verse number 6. When Seth had lived 105 years, the Septuagint says 205 years, he fathered Enosh. And Seth lived, after he'd fathered Enosh, 807 years, had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Seth were 912 years. And that number is the same in both texts. When Enosh had lived 90 years, and the Septuagint has 190 years, he fathered Kenan. Enosh lived, after he'd fathered Kenan, 815 years. He had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enosh were 905 years. That's the same in both texts. And by the way, the number in between those, the number of years after giving birth until dying, that's altered, or it's different in the Septuagint, but the numbers all add up to the same final figure. Verse number 12. When Kenan had lived 70 years, Septuagint says 170 years, he fathered Mahalalel. And then Kenan lived, after he'd fathered Mahalalel, 840 years, had other sons and daughters, and thus all the days of Kenan were 910 years. Same number in both. And then he died. When Mahalalel had lived 65 years, guess what? Septuagint says 165. He fathered Jared. Mahalalel lived, after he had fathered Jared, 830 years, had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years. Same number in both. And then he died. When Jared had lived 162 years. Now, this is interesting because the Masoretic text has the exact same number that the Septuagint has. So this might be one of those places to help us understand that somebody had dropped the 100-year part in the earlier ones for whatever reason, either inattention or possibly because whoever was working on that section as a scribe couldn't believe that people were living that long before they had children. But this is where we have both agree that Enoch was born in the 162nd year of Jared's life. Verse number 19, Jared lived after he fathered Enoch 800 years, had other sons and daughters. All the days of Jared were 962 years, same number in both, and he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, let's see, I've got to check my my words here. Yeah, it's 162. No, that's not correct. It's 165 in the Septuagint. So 100 years is missing from the Masoretic text. When Enoch had lived 65 or 165 years, he fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years, and he had other sons and daughters, and all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And 365 is the same between the Masoretic and the Septuagint text. And this is the first time we have someone not live up into their 900s before dying, or in this case, before passing from the pages of history. Because Enoch's story is unique. Something special happens with him that is mentioned in the next verse. Verse 24, Enoch walked with God. He was not, for God took him. So he just disappears from planet Earth. New Testaments talk about him being translated. That means he is taken away. Now, I am of the opinion, and again, folks, my opinion's only worth what you're paying for, which is nothing at this point. I am of the opinion that Enoch is one of two gentlemen that God has a special assignment for farther ahead in time. And God pulls him from his time period in the 365th year of his life, which means that he was still a fairly young person. It would be equivalent to being your later 20s in our time span. So he is pulled out of his time period, and I believe he becomes one of the two witnesses in the book of Revelation chapter 11. And that the other gentleman that is pulled out of time is Elijah, who disappears with the whirlwind of fire, with the chariot of God, and is no longer seen. He does not die, he's just gone. And you know that Jewish tradition, based on the book of Malachi, was the expectation that he would be back in close proximity to the coming of the Messiah. And so I think that both Elijah and Enoch are pulled forward in time, even past where we're living right now, to be the two witnesses that will give their lives at the end of that 3.5-year ministry, just about 10 days before the second coming of Jesus Christ. If you're interested in that theory and a little bit more detail, I would invite you to check out my Living in the Last Days Prophecy seminar notes, which can also be found in the resources section of IntoTheWord2020.com. Verse 25 now. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, same number in both texts, he fathered Lamech. Methuselah lived after he fathered Lamech 782 years and had other sons and daughters. And thus all the days of Methuselah were 969 years and he died. Methuselah stands as the oldest human to live on the face of the earth, 969 years. Now, if you take Enoch out of the equation and take Lamech out of the equation, because he has a shorter lifespan, most of these guys are living into their 900s. And that seems to be because of the environment and the nutrition that they are taking into their bodies. Verse 28, when Lamech had lived 122 years, and that is 188 years in the Septuagint. So it's the first time that we've got a significantly different number rather than just adding 100 or subtracting 100. When Lamech had lived 122 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noach, or Noah, saying, out of the ground that that he who is has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. So Lamech knew something about his son Noah. Knew it, he was a special one that was going to radically change the situation. He didn't understand perfectly what that was, but he had some sort of understanding. Lamech lived after he fathered Noah 595 years, had other sons and daughters, and thus all the days of Lamech were 777 years. In the Septuagint, it is 753 years, and then he died. We've only got about 30 seconds left, so we're going to save the next generation until tomorrow. What we've just seen is the connection of creation to the story of the flood, and how these several thousand years we see the disintegration of man into the depths of sin and the need for God to start afresh with a righteous man and his family.